I think we had you here about 2 years ago.
Yes, I think it was about 2 years ago. And
happy to be here.
Sorry to be here.
Happy to be here. Very nice stories. So I'm a regular listener. If I can't listen, if something is going on, I usually tape it and play it back. And,
So, like, what would be going on that would keep you from it? I mean, like, for example.
Well, I might.
Like yard work, or.
Well. I think we discussed a couple of years ago when you were here, there was a conflict. Henry Morgan was on opposite you here in New York.
Oh, yeah?
And so I happen to love Henry Morgan.
Is he still at WOR?
No, they let him go. They let the people over here go. I hear he does a lot of voiceovers, a lot of national spots, a lot of things like that.
It's good.
But he had a very interesting show because he was very snappish with people. And so these dullards would call up on the phone and he would let them know that he thought they were dullards. And he did not handle them with any finesse at all.
No.
That's Henry. But he had a very interesting show and he'd try to include his wife and everything. It was quite nice. So what I would usually do would be to tape you because that way I could listen to the music and, you know, enjoy it. Turn it off and on, not miss anything, and listen to Henry. But now he's not on anymore, so I usually listen to you.
You can be kind of snappish with people when you're 70 years old. He just turned 70 this year.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. I remember listening to him when I was a kid. He used to do a...
There you are, though, you see. That's what made him 70.
That's true.
Is you were listening to him when you were a kid.
That's right. He used to have a monologue, and it would be he had a show in which he stood outside of a cigar store and commented about life and things, and perhaps not unlike what you do to a certain degree.
Then you got sidetracked by television, but that was understandable. He became a panelist. And kind of a celebrity without doing much.
Well, you're not shy now, are you, after making all of these public appearances?
Even more so.
Right.
Of course. It's a reaction, you know, to all this stuff. You sign books for about 2 hours, it'll make you shy. You want to be by yourself for a week after that.
If anybody should be shy, it's the guy who has to do the interviewing. He's the one who has to ask the questions, keep things moving, lively, exciting. And, that's really hard. Really hard for someone who does a literary broadcast to do that.
It's going to be easy, though, today.
I share a certain geographical relationship with you, being from Kansas. Kansas, of course, is not quite as glamorous as Minnesota. And obviously there are a lot of backward people from Kansas, which is myself, so from that standpoint, to being Midwesterners and sharing the flatlands, I guess makes both of us kind of shy.
Well, I think there's a lot of grandeur to Kansas, but part of Kansas's problem is that it's not really Midwestern, and it's not really Western. It doesn't fit easily into anyone's picture of the country or into any sort of map that anyone has. Minnesota's, you know, up on the northern tier, and it anchors the western end of the Great Lakes, and so people have that fixed, and they associate us with vicious winters and Scandinavians.
There was a marvel.
The Mississippi.
Marvelous book written by a writer by the name of William Least Heat Moon called Blue Highways. Did you happen to read it?
I read that book, yeah.
William Least Heat Moon has been in seeing me a couple of times, and one of his problems, he'd outfitted this van, and he went all around the nation on the secondary roadways, and he had no problem talking to people all through the South, all through the West, but when he got to Minnesota, that part of the book became very, very short. He found it very difficult to draw out people in Minnesota. Why is that?
They knew that he was a writer. This man was trucking around the country for no purpose but to write a book. And that is a dishonorable enterprise. I mean, I would do it myself in a minute. I'd enjoy doing it, but I would also realize that it's dishonorable. And they don't want to have anything to do with somebody who's going to write a book. That guy who went down to Mississippi, that snotty Englishman who wrote that book, what was it, Old Glory or something, Jonathan Rabin, I mean, he just skewered Minnesota. John Steinbeck didn't particularly like it when he wrote Travels with Charlie. Most people who travel around the country with a book in mind, I think, are pretty obvious about it.
Yeah,
Southerners would love to be in anybody's book. I mean, Southerners, if you're a writer, that's all great. And if you've brought a tape recorder, all the better. But Minnesota just isn't that way.
Certainly Garrison Keillor wouldn't travel around the country with a book in mind.
No, not yet. Maybe someday I would.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to your hometown. Is it pronounced Anoka?
Anoka, yeah.
Which obviously is the model for Lake Wobegon. What sort of reputation have you developed in Anoka now that people grew up with, and your relatives and your family and neighbors and all that know exactly what you are, what you turn out to be? And they say that we knew that Keillor boy was going to turn out to be the way he is.
People in my hometown are not great readers of American fiction, nor are they listeners to public radio. So they don't really know all that much about what I've been up to since I left almost 25 years ago. They're curious about it, but only up to a point. They ask me what I'm doing now, and I tell them I'm in the radio business. They don't know if I repair radios, if I talk on radios, if I sell radios to people. But it sounds good enough to them, and we let it go at that.
So most of them do not listen to the broadcast?
Not that I've ever been able to figure out. No, I don't think they do.
I have a feeling that probably they do a lot of watching of cable, and the cable television was to come into the area by now. They probably watch television a lot.
Cable television has not really made a big dent in Minnesota, and it has not arrived in my hometown. These cables are being strung very, very slowly, and they haven't arrived there yet. In fact, I don't really know what you mean by cable. There's some kind of a wire that comes into the back of your TV?
I'm not sure what cable is myself, although I have it. Mm-hmm. But they pipe it into your house on a telephone wire or something, and you don't have to have an antenna on the roof. Or a satellite dish. You can just turn on the radio or the television, rather, and it's there without any ghosts or shadows.
What would be the advantage of that, though? Right?
Well, if you live in a... Say you live in a flat area where you don't have problems with reception, but if you were a cliff dweller living in Manhattan, you'd have all sorts of problems. You couldn't watch anything. Nothing.
Yeah, but
just
if you...
Shadows. So that's why people here in Manhattan many years ago began installing cable, television sets in their homes so they could watch something at night. It gets boring in New York, and so they wanted to watch television, and they couldn't do it just by using rabbit ears and rooftop antennas.
But watch what is the question? I mean, does it deliver great stuff to your home, or just more of the same?
Well, it delivers terrific stuff. You get movies that are uncut, all the R-rated movies. Terrific material. You don't have to plow through commercials or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a whole bunch of neighborhood channels called public access channels.
Mm-hmm.
This is when people can rent 30 minutes of airtime and make fools of themselves by saying anything they want on television. Nobody watches these public access channels except when they get drunk, and they want a few laughs at night.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I live in an apartment building that has a television camera in the lobby, and it comes in on channel H on my cable television set. Somebody rings my bell, I can run over, turn on the television set, wait for it to warm up, switch it to channel H, see who's there. By that time, the person is gone, of course. But it's an advantage. When you have a party, you can turn on Channel H, the guard channel, and watch people ring your bell. Everybody gets a laugh. Wonderful thing. People, you should have that in Anoka. They should have that. They could, you know, they have a television camera focused on their front door. People ring the bell. They could run to the television set, see who's ringing their bell. They don't have to open the curtains or anything like that.
No, I mean, this, my whole feeling about television, though, is that something that gets better when you are drunk is extremely questionable. It's one of the few things. Books don't get better when you're drunk. Food doesn't. Sex doesn't. Television is one of the few things that does, and that makes me ask all sorts of questions about it.
Speaking of drunk, Minnesota has these long, long winters, and I had heard complaints from people who live in New England, which they have similar types of winters.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, and there seems to be a problem in New England with people not having enough to do, and so they do a lot of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your feeling in the Minnesota and the upper Midwest, that alcohol replaces a lot of activity in the winter?
It is sad. It is sad. There is a problem, I think, in cold weather states. It's sort of a joke you see among people, and but I don't joke about it anymore. I used to tell jokes about people getting drunk and doing strange things. But then my listeners started to write to me, and people are sensible, and they will correct you when you step off in the wrong direction. So I don't talk about that anymore. It's a sad problem. That's absolutely true, particularly in rural areas and deserted areas. You find a lot of it.
I was talking to Roy Blunt not too long ago, and complaining that there had not been a book out of the Garrison Keillor monologues. And he said, well, of course, there's unlikely to be, because Garrison never writes these things down, although many of them sounded to me as though they had been, well, they're so dramatic, they sounded well-rehearsed, in fact. They sound spontaneous at the same time, but done in such a marvelous delivery that I wondered about the amount of planning and preparation. But in some of the publicity material that Viking sent over, it said, no, you never made a script, or you work from notes for these monologues. I wanted to ask you about that. I would have been satisfied just to have transcripts of the monologues, but what you did for Lake Wobegon Days, the book, is to change the monologues into a running story, almost a novelization. Let's talk a little bit about how you approach these monologues, how you prepare them, and then how you were able to shift them into this marvelous book.
I start out when I am thinking of a show coming up. I start out with a few images, just a few clear pictures in my mind, if I can. And somehow a story will almost always come out of them. I think that almost any object you could look at, almost any line of dialogue that you overhear, it's like, I don't know, it's like a molecule that if you study it and contemplate it, you can reconstruct the whole from which it came. I start out with a story in my head, and I try to write down as much of it as I can without creating a script which would then bind me to repeat back to the audience what I had already written on a page, which I don't want to do. Because in the moment when you stand on stage on a live radio broadcast in front of an audience and being aware of a larger audience beyond it in the dark, some marvelous things are possible there when you're scared and you're on the spot. Some wonderful things are possible which you should not deny yourself by being overly prepared. You always want to leave yourself in a little danger so that things will come to you, possibly may come to you as you talk.
Had it occurred to you that you might well be able to make additional use of these monologues, which obviously you did, as you did the monologues over the years, did you salt them away? Obviously you tape recorded them, make transcripts, something like that. Idea of perhaps making them into a book.
I didn't think of writing this book. I was quite satisfied to do the monologues until people started writing about the show in newspapers and magazines, and they started using three different words to describe Lake Wobegon and the stories about it. They used the word whimsical, they used the word down home, and the word nostalgic. And I don't think the stories ever were or are now any of those three. But once writers, reporters, get hold of a few words of description, they are reluctant to let go of them. And that was when I started to think I wanted to write a book based on the monologues to show what they really were about. Because, you see, radio is ephemeral. It's just out there in the air for a moment, and then it's all gone. But print lasts, and it drifts along. It goes and settles in a library somewhere, but it exists long after the fact. So I wanted to give these stories a longer life and defend myself against the accusation of being whimsical, nostalgic, and down home.
Nostalgic, perhaps. Whimsical, I'm not sure about that description. I agree with you there. Did you add, you obviously added material, for example, the lengthy history of Lake Wobegon, or did you have those as some part of your monologues over the years as well?
No, I've never gone into the history of the town very much at all. I've left that pretty much, pretty vague. Never knew people were interested, I guess.
It's quite funny. Tell me about how Lake Wobegon never appears on any maps.
Lake Wobegon was founded back in about 1855, 1853, in around there, before the Civil War. And after the Civil War, a team of surveyors, of Irish surveyors, came out from Grant's army to survey the state of Minnesota, working their way towards the middle from the four corners of the state. And they were in no condition to do it, and surveyed more of Minnesota than there was room for between the boundaries allotted by Congress when the state was admitted to the Union in 1851. And so rather than change the boundaries, rather than go back and do the whole job over again, they had to overlap the four inner corners of the map, and my town wound up on the bottom flap. But not appearing on the map turns out not to be the disadvantage that you might think. Being fictional has not been that great a handicap for Lake Wobegon either. You might think it would be, but being a fictional town, I think, opens up a lot of choices for them that they wouldn't have if they were real.
Of course, your real hometown of Anoka is on the map. Are there parallels between Anoka and the fictional Lake Wobegon in terms of its development, as you describe in the book?
I don't think so. I think Anoka has changed so much since I lived there, and has become almost a suburb of Minneapolis, which Lake Wobegon is not. It is about as far from Minneapolis as you can get and still be in Minnesota.
You studied what at the University of Minnesota?
I studied English, like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
We all were English majors, as far as I was concerned. There might have been a few people in engineering, I don't know.
Lake Wobegon Days is your second book after the book of short stories of almost 2 years ago, I guess, that came out.
Mm-hmm.
as an English major, had been in your mind that you would perhaps write at some point? I know you were working at the campus radio station, so obviously you also made the broadcasting a career. But somewhere along the line, you had to kind of decide, well, what am I going to do? And obviously, it was broadcasting, but the English served you well, apparently.
When I was in college, we did not read fiction that was set in Minnesota. Sinclair Lewis, who's from Minnesota, F. Scott Fitzgerald, too, but their fiction had been written many years before and was not particularly well thought of by my English professors. My English professors led us back into the 18th century and 19th century in England, and that is where I spent most of my time. So I never considered that somebody from Minnesota could write a book about growing up there. That did not really occur to me until much later. I hope that it's possible because I've just done it. But I did not think at the time that it was anything I would do. We were taught reverence for books, you know. We really worshipped books in college. And so you tend to think that, you know, if it were something that you yourself could do, then it wouldn't be worthy of all that reverence, then, would it? You know, it's like Groucho said, you know, any club that would have me for a member, I wouldn't want to join it.
Your first published work, was that in the New Yorker?
Well, I published stuff in papers and magazines, going back to mimeographed work, you know, when I was in the seventh grade. We put out a paper, in fact, in the sixth grade. I was the founder of a paper that was printed by the hectograph process. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm, yeah, it uses the gelatin mold.
It has a gel which lies flat. Now, of course, in days of photocopying, why, nobody would know anything about it. But you'd write with a special ink on paper and then put that face down on this gelatin, lift it up, and there it would be. And it would make about 20 or 30 clear impressions, and then about 15 blurrier and blurrier impressions. You could have a run of as many as 45 issues off a hectograph.
Boy, what a mess. I used to use one to make my own neighborhood newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, what a mess. We don't even use carbon paper anymore.
No.
A neighbor came up and knocked at my door a few days ago and asked if I had some carbon paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was trying to write a letter, and I fished around. I found some brittle carbon paper that must have been 20 years old, and able to give it to her.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific what we've done to make life and writing easier for us. Doesn't make us write better. I'm sure that people who use a hectograph were as, at least if they didn't write that well, at least they were inventive and they wanted to do it, and they overcame somehow the technical disadvantages of that sort of duplicating process to go ahead and do it. People do anything to write. I mean, they write on walls of caves.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way we go.
That's true. There are too many copies of things now. People copy anything at all that makes any sort of remote sense or is even remotely humorous. People who have access to a photocopying machine will run off dozens of copies of it. The world is just sinking under paper, I think, sometimes. But with a hectograph and with carbon paper, you had to want to have copies, you know, to make them. You had to think of it in advance. This is making us sound awfully old, you know.
Well, speak for yourself. You've done a nice job in combining a radio career with your literary interests. I certainly think that Lake Wobegon's works as a piece of writing. And as I've started to mention before, I would have been happy just to have had in printed form the monologues. But in doing it the way you've done it, you have interwoven the lives and origins, the lives of the people and the origins of the town in a novelized form that makes for delightful reading. One thing that you do, both in the book and in your monologues, you poke fun at religion a little, but in a way that indicates that you take religion very seriously, and I presume this is something that is endemic to the Middle West.
These are God-fearing people who I come from. The Catholics and the Lutherans and then my people, the Sanctified Brethren, are God-fearing people. And they believe, as I do, that when you embrace the Christian faith, that you are called to a very high standard. And you then allow yourself to be compared to that standard. And that's the satire in this book as regards religious people, is simply holding them up to the standard that they have professed. And it's humorous, you see. But that is not to satirize the faith itself, you see. The faith itself is the basis of the satire, not the object of it. I believe that all satire is moral. And for myself, the only satire that makes sense is satire that's based on the gospel. That might strike people as strange, but I think if you consider it, that it makes sense.
Do your listeners criticize you at all in terms of the satire that you do about religion?
Oh, they criticize me all the time. But oftentimes the customer is wrong. Oftentimes the customer is dead wrong. You have to keep that in mind, you know.
Have you always lived in Minnesota?
I've lived in Minnesota all my life. When my dad went off to the army, my mother and I and an older brother and sister lived for about 6 months in Davenport, Iowa. That's the only time I've been out of the state, and I was only 2 at the time, so it didn't make a big impression on me.
You have taken your broadcast around the country to Nashville, to Memphis. I think you were in New Orleans. You've been on the West Coast. Over the summer, I think you were in Red Wing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Red Wing doesn't count. But you,
Red Wing does count.
Dozens of people in Red Wing.
It counts extra. Red Wing counts extra. 5 points extra.
But here you've taken the broadcast out of Minnesota. You've done a lot of traveling. But I would imagine that you are usually anxious to get back to the familiar stomping ground after seeing the sights outside of the borders of Minnesota.
Why would you imagine that?
You don't? You do?
I don't know. I'm curious why you would assume or imagine that I would. I have a wee of a time when I leave home. I have a very good time. People from Minnesota are good travelers. We are not stuck there. We live there by choice. But we love to gad about and to be around people who are different from ourselves and who talk funny and who believe strange things. Minnesota is a great exporter of people and has been for most of its history. And I believe that we travel well. We are good listeners, and we do not travel in order to sell Minnesota. I travel sometimes in order to sell my book, but only as I have to. We make good travelers. And then when we run out of money, we go back home. And after we've been home for a while, then we enjoy it and realize that's where we want to be all along.
And in fact, there's a stretch of 9th Avenue in Manhattan that is known as the Minnesota Strip.
Not named by me or by folks from where I come from.
Well, it was good to see you again and to have you back. I really enjoyed the book, and as much as I enjoy the show, it'd be very interesting. I just thinking that if you ever wanted to leave Minnesota and continue to do the Prairie Home Companion, say in Manhattan, just see you packing an audience into an upper floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, for example, and doing the Prairie Home Companion. I don't know if it would work. I mean, I could see a visiting tour. I think you're going to bring the show here, aren't you, after a bit? Or yeah, I know you've had been at Town Hall, I believe, in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But just kind of hard to imagine the Prairie Home Companion emanating from Manhattan.
Oh, no. It could emanate here very easily. We did it once before. I think it would be very easy. But I wouldn't want to move to Manhattan. I wouldn't want to live here. I think I'll do this show for a few more years. And then I think what I ought to do is go live in a foreign country. I think that's what I will do. I think that would be the best thing for me as a writer.
Scandinavian country?
I would love to live in Scandinavia. But I have friends who, after living all their lives in Minnesota, moved to Mexico and lived. They live in a small village. They're the only Americans. And they built their own house. And getting along famously. They love it. I put them into my monologues years ago as relatives of the Bunsens. But I wouldn't want to live in any other part of America. I'd want to live in some place that really is strange.
How about Kansas?
New York is too familiar.
Harrison Keeler, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. I hope this wasn't too much of an ordeal for a shy person.
Nope, I had a good time. Thank you.
How long will you be in town?
I'll be in town through Thursday evening. Torsday.
Well, you have you have quite a schedule, don't you? You had quite a schedule. Let's see it here, Roger.
Yeah.
Miami, Detroit, Cleveland, Boston. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. You know how many people would like to write a book and be able to travel and.
It's fun. It's fun, and they're right to want to do it. And authors who complain about it are just complaining, that's all.